What is the No Spin News all about?
You know that this is a fact-based analysis news program. You know that. We avoid speculation. We don't do conspiracies here. We don't do party politics here. We're not nonpartisan. That's wrong. Not that. Okay, we are advocates for a stronger America and a more just society. We don't believe in communism. We don't believe in socialism. We don't believe in nihilism. We don't believe in the progressive woke culture. We think it is un-American. We don't support that. So you should know what we are. And it would then crystallize what we do.
Listen to the No Spin News. Subscribe to Bill O'Reilly's podcast feed wherever podcasts are available.
I'm Josh Hammer, and welcome back to America on Trial, your one-stop shop for all your legal news pertaining to the 2024 presidential election and all the major pressing legal headlines, for that matter, affecting our great country and our American way of life. On today's show, the national conversation is still percolating when it comes to the ever-thorny issue of abortion, given recent moves from President Trump, the Florida Supreme Court, and so forth when it comes to that issue. I've got a lot to say on this issue. I want to spend another deep dive segment explaining to you why I think that what's happening right now is okay for the short term, but in the long term, this is going to have to get resolved in a very different way. I'll unpack that and more in today's deep dive segment. And then later on in today's closing argument, we'll mix it up a little bit. The UConn Huskies, they are national champions in college basketball for the sixth time since 1999. We'll talk about the legacy that they are building there in Storrs, Connecticut. If you're a sports fan, you're not going to want to miss that one. But staying on substance for a minute there, it is a jam-packed news cycle out there when it comes to all of our legal headlines. So without further ado, let's go around the horn. We begin in Fulton County, Georgia. Now, if you're more of a casual listener of America on Trial with Josh Hammer, and you shouldn't be a casual listener, you should be a daily listener, go ahead and leave us that five-star review, of course. But if you're a more casual listener and you were tuning in a couple months ago but haven't been checking in as often recently, you might be asking yourself, wow, what's going on in Fulton County, Georgia? I mean, this was the case that was getting so much attention in late January into February. We had that bombshell evidentiary hearing where Fannie Willis, the district attorney, looked like a complete nincompoop up there on the stand. Well, the litigation in Fulton County, Georgia, it is now pending before an appellate judge above the trial judge, above Judge Scott McAfee, as to whether Donald Trump and his co-defendants can seek still to have Fannie Willis removed from this case. Trump had already submitted his filing to the appellate court sitting above Judge McAfee, arguing that the remedy that McAfee had devised that allowed Fannie Willis to stay on the case, Trump had already submitted his filing, arguing that this remedy was incorrect and that as a matter of law, it is his appellate right. And under Georgia law, the appellate court must actually disqualify Fannie Willis. Well, as was anticipated yesterday on Monday, April 8th, the Fulton County Prosecutor's Office did submit their own paperwork urging the State Court of Appeals sitting above Judge Scott McAfee not to allow Fannie Willis to be disqualified and to say that this should be dismissed, that Trump and his co-defendants are wrong to get this right of immediate appeal because Scott McAfee, they argue, actually got it right, that he got it right, they say, when he said that Nathan Wade, the illicit ex-lover of a special prosecutor, had to go off the case due to a perceived conflict of interest, but Fannie Willis could actually stay on the case. Trump and his eight co-defendants, as I said, have already submitted paperwork disagreeing with that. And the paperwork, the filing that Fannie Willis' office filed yesterday in Fulton County is pretty straightforward stuff. They argue that the defendants, quote, have wholly failed to carry their burden of persuasion. That filing was due on Thursday. They submitted it a little early. So now it is now pending before the State Court of Appeals there in Fulton County, Georgia, to ascertain whether or not they're even going to hear this appeal of her dismissal. And if they reject it, then it's going to go back down to trial court to actually start those proceedings. So that is where things currently stand in Fulton County, Georgia. Going from Fulton County, Georgia, up to New York City for a moment here. In New York City, Donald Trump has lost what looks like his last Hail Mary attempt to delay the hush money payment Alvin Bragg criminal trial. So that case was going to start on March 25th. It would have started already. It was delayed by the presiding judge, the compromised Judge Juan Merchan, the judge whose daughter is a prolific Democratic Party fundraising activist who seems to be profiting off of her father's work prosecuting the former president. It is really quite an unfortunate turn of events there when it comes to this conflict of interest. But the latest attempt to delay this trial from Donald Trump was that he had his lawyers move to remove this case from Manhattan and move it to Staten Island. Now, Staten Island, for those of you less familiar with New York geography, it is the least populated and probably the least discussed of the five boroughs of New York City. It is also the only red jurisdiction in New York City. It is the only borough that Donald Trump won in both 2016 and 2020. It's kind of a hub of a more commonsensical blue-collar Republican sentiment there, a lot of New York Post readers and so forth. Donald Trump was trying to get the case removed there, and that has been rejected. It was rejected by a New York appellate division judge, a judge by the name of Lisbeth Gonzalez. She rejected this claim. And so that looks like it's probably it. That was probably the last Hail Mary attempt to get this thing delayed. So mark your calendars, folks. Jury selection voir dire there in the Alvin Bragg brought hush money payment case against Donald Trump involving Michael Cohen, Stormy Daniels, and that whole Mary band of characters. That thing is going to start on Monday, pending unforeseen events. You never know what could happen, but that thing, it looks like it is going to start on Monday, April 15th. It's worth bearing in mind there that we had this recent extensive gag order placed on Donald Trump from the judge there, Juan Merchan, the gag order pertaining to basically everyone except for the judge himself and Alvin Bragg himself there. Trump is still going to have the ability to appeal that gag order as well, but his last attempt at delay has been thwarted by the New York State Supreme Court Appellate Division. From New York City down to Washington, D.C., yesterday was also brief filing day for special counsel Jack Smith in the immunity case. So this is the so-called election interference case pertaining to the 2020 election, January 6, 2021. This is the case of the four criminal prosecutions against Donald Trump. This is the case where the feds, where Jack Smith, Merrick Garland, Joe Biden, the entire Democrat lawfare complex, as I like to call it, this is the case where they are basically putting all of their eggs in their basket at this point, especially given the way that the Georgia case has been going, the fact that they're unlikely to get that Georgia case across the finish line. The DC case is really the one for all of the marbles, or at least most of the marbles. And right now, they are having this interlocutory appeal, this threshold question of the scope of immunity, which they first have to answer before they can even ascertain as to whether Jack Smith's probe there in DC can continue in the first place. That oral argument of the Supreme Court, as we've noted repeatedly on this show, is coming up rapidly. It is going to be on April 25th at the United States Supreme Court. Trump and his amicus briefs, his friend of the court briefs, they had already filed when it came to the scope and the breadth and depth of presidential immunity from future criminal prosecution after a president leaves office. Well, Jack Smith, the special counsel, filed his much-anticipated brief yesterday. It is a 66-page filing. I'll read you some snippets. Quote, this is from Jack Smith writing in his immunity brief to the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday, April 8th, 2024. Quote, the framers never endorsed criminal immunity for a former president, and all presidents from the founding to the modern era have known that after leaving office, they face potential criminal liability for official acts. A little later on, he says, quote, no presidential power at issue in this case entitles the president to claim immunity from the general federal criminal prohibition supporting the charges, fraud against the United States, obstruction of official proceedings, and denial of the right to vote. So that is Jack Smith's theory of the case in a nutshell. I would briefly note that when he's saying that all presidents from the founding to the modern era have known that after leaving office, they face potential criminal liability, I have no idea where he is getting that from. I truly have no idea where Jack Smith is getting this from. What former president has actually faced criminal liability after leaving office? Seriously, I mean, you had the Nixon versus Fitzgerald precedent from 1982, which actually concluded the exact opposite, which is that former presidents, after they leave office, cannot be subject to civil liability for actions that they took in their capacity as then sitting presidents of the United States. So I have no idea where Jack Smith is getting this from. I continue to predict that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to issue something of a middle-of-the-road opinion here, where they're going to say that some acts are subject to criminal immunity, some acts are not, and then they will have to remand for fact-finding to a lower court. All of this, as I've discussed on this show, will have the effect of kicking this can down the road and further delaying the start date of this prosecution in District Court Judge Tanya Chutkan's courtroom. Staying in Washington, D.C., just a brief update. House Republicans on the Oversight Committee led by Congressman Comer of Kentucky and the Judiciary Committee led by Jim Jordan of Ohio had been seeking the audio of former special counsel Robert Hur's interview with President Joe Biden. Robert Hur was the special counsel who was tasked with investigating and issuing his report on President Joe Biden's own mishandling of classified documents. We discussed that report at great length on this show in February when he released it. Well, Congressman Comer and Congressman Jordan were trying to get the audio of this interview. They wanted the full audio, and for now, the Justice Department is actually rebuffing them. Here's a quote from Carlos Uriarte, who's an assistant attorney general in the U.S. Department of Justice. Quote, even assuming the committees did have a remaining investigative purpose behind the request for the audio files that has not been rebutted by the information produced so far, it is critical for the department to understand why the committees believe they have a remaining need for the information in these files. Well, look, this is a classic separation of powers inter-branch struggle here, so it's going to be interesting to see the way that this plays out. I think that Comer and Jordan are on solid grounds to request the audio. They have legitimate investigative reasons, I would think, to listen to this thing and see if there is potential need for subpoenas or potential criminal filings or anything that might go forward from there. So we'll see how this ends up, but for now, just bear in mind that the DOJ is rebuffing their request to get that full audio from former special counsel Robert Hur's interview of President Joe Biden. Finally, our final note today for our jam-packed Around the Horn segment, staying in Washington, D.C., a brief note that Joe Biden has announced a second attempt at a sprawling student loan forgiveness program. So this is not deja vu all over again. He first had an attempt at a mass student loan forgiveness program that was nullified by the Supreme Court last year in a 6-3 decision in the Biden versus Nebraska case. In the Nebraska litigation, the court held that Biden's purported statutory authority to issue his previous $400 billion in federal student loans, the HEROES Act, which was a post-9/11 era statute, they said that you could not do this, that this was not an appropriate statute to tendentiously invoke for one's own totally unrelated purposes to grant this massive $400 billion in student loan forgiveness, that you really need new legislation for this. That was entirely correct. So the U.S. Education Department's new plan, which they announced yesterday on Monday, April 8th, first, it's going to take aim at borrowers who have seen their balances climb due to unpaid interest. It's going to try to cancel up to $20,000 of accrued interest for student loan borrowers. And then furthermore, it's going to try to cancel student loan balances for those who entered repayment more than 20 years ago for undergraduate loans and more than 25 years ago for graduate loans. So it's ultimately, if they're successful, it's still going to cost a heck of a lot of money, potentially also up to hundreds of billions of dollars. We're going to start to see some more litigation on this, and we will try to track it the best we can for you here on America on Trial. Clearly seems to me like something that is not done for substance, but really just as an election year political gambit trying to shore up that Gen Z and millennial support, which current polling indicates is really going wobbly for the current president. That Gen Z millennial vote increasingly looks like it is rather Trumpy, surprising though that may be to many folks. Well, that's it for today's jam-packed Around the Horn segment. Up next in today's deep dive, we'll get back into the weeds on abortion. This issue is still percolating in the national discourse. We'll get into it. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Mike Slater from the podcast Politics by Faith. This is a crazy time in our country. It's stressful, a lot of anxiety, and it's going to get worse. And I realized that one of the things that helps me take away the stress is realizing that there's nothing new under the sun. So on this podcast, we take the news of the day, and we run it through the Bible and other periods in history to realize that we've been through this before and we can rise above again. Politics by Faith, anywhere you listen to the podcast. Politics by Faith.
Welcome back. It's time for today's deep dive. As we noted on yesterday's program, Donald Trump unveiled his much-anticipated 2024 stance on the ever-pressing issue of abortion and the right to life yesterday morning. He did something that makes a lot of sense for a lot of politicians, but runs a huge risk, which is where you try to concoct somewhat of a middle ground remedy, trying to make everyone happy. The obvious risk that you run in trying to make everyone happy, as Chief Justice John Roberts has learned all too well over the up and down course of his now almost 20-year tenure as U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice, the risk that you run is that in trying to make everyone happy, you perhaps end up making absolutely no one happy. Now, Trump's stance, as we shared yesterday, is that the federal government should have nothing to do with the issue of abortion and that it should be back to the states. Now, this immediately engendered something of a fiery backlash, and pro-life activist groups such as the Susan B. Anthony List and Americans United for Life, Marjorie Danfelser, the head of the Susan B. Anthony List, put out a pretty blistering statement saying that Trump's stance was totally unacceptable. Like many of the national pro-life groups, Susan B. Anthony List was pushing for, at a bare minimum, a 15-week national ban as the stance that the Republican nominee ought to take. That was the stance that was taken from numerous of Donald Trump's competitors in the Republican presidential primary. Mike Pence took that stance. Ron DeSantis took that stance. Others took that stance as well. Now, this is a perilous moment. This is a perilous moment, and it's one that has me quite conflicted because, on the one hand, I am a pro-life activist. I helped revive from the dead our Law Students for Life chapter back when I was in law school. I have marched in Marches for Life. I have spoken at numerous pro-life conferences over the years. I have spilled a lot of ink on this particular topic. On the other hand, I live in the real world, and I have seen the way that the ballot referenda and the ballot initiatives on this particular question have played out since the June 2022 Dobbs case that overturned Roe versus Wade. Most recently, Issue 1 in Ohio, which is a red-leaning state these days, Ohio, and how Issue 1 there lost by a 57-43 margin, mirroring, roughly speaking, the margin that these other initiatives have prevailed by, these abortion initiatives have prevailed by in states like Michigan and Kansas as well. So, just a bit of a word on this. This morning, Trump on Truth Social blasted Marjorie Danfelser and Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina. I'm not a huge fan of Lindsey Graham, to put it mildly, but to his credit, he has supported a 15 or 20 week minimum national abortion backstop in the past. Now, Trump's stance, which is a full kind of 10th Amendment states' rightsy stance, that's what he put on Truth Social this morning. On the one hand, it tactically makes a good deal of sense. For this election cycle this fall, the issues where Republicans are going to win on are immigration, crime, and the economy. They do not want this election to be contested on the terrain of abortion. You know, as I tweeted yesterday, there is this great quote that I like to whip out every so often from Sun Tzu, the ancient Chinese military strategist and historian. And Sun Tzu famously said that a battle is won before it is fought, and it is won by choosing the terrain on which it is fought. Now, this fall, that increasingly looks like that terrain the Republicans want to fight on are immigration, crime, and the economy. Those are the issues. Those are the issues that, if you look at it, that's where independent voters most closely align with the Republican positions and the more conservative approach to public policy in general. So from that perspective, Trump's stance actually makes a lot of sense. However, it is not the correct long-term solution to the problem. It is okay, I think, as a kick the can down the road measure for now, given the current state of public polling, given the current state of where hearts and minds are on this issue. But ultimately, this issue cannot possibly be resolved at the state level. We ultimately are going to need some sort of national resolution to the abortion question. Let's go back briefly, take a history lesson back to 1858. The Lincoln-Douglas debates in 1858 continue to inspire any law student or any graduate student who has gone back and read some of these transcripts. You see just the power of the political rhetoric, and you see two entirely different views of governance, of the rights of man, on the nature of our transcendental order. You see these two competing worldviews just clashing on this elaborate stage, the debates that they did up and down the state of Illinois when they were contesting for that U.S. Senate seat that year in 1858 in Illinois. And time and again, when the question of slavery came up, when the question of slavery in the Western territories came up, which was one of the big pressing issues of the day, Stephen Douglas, the Democrat, said over and over again that it should be decided by popular sovereignty in the Western territories. This was the functional equivalent of a 10th Amendment states' rights position. He basically said it should be decided by popular sovereignty and majoritarianism in the Western territories. Now, the reason that we remember, though, Abraham Lincoln and not Stephen Douglas, because Lincoln comes over the top of Douglas and comes over the top of his appeal to majoritarianism and popular sovereignty. And Lincoln invokes concepts such as substantive justice and the natural rights of man and things of that nature there. Those are the key questions that one confronts when one actually looks at the abortion question itself. The 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, the Equal Protection Clause reads in relevant part, "No state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws." Well, what if the term person, as it is used in the Equal Protection Clause, actually includes unborn human beings? That is actually the position that I have been advocating for in my various platforms and capacities for a number of years now. And in the Dobbs case, it is worth noting, there were actually some very high-profile amicus briefs, some friend of the court briefs that were filed in that case that actually made this exact same argument. Perhaps the most high-profile of those briefs was one co-written by Robbie George, the great Princeton University scholar and social conservative. He co-wrote an amicus brief there with John Finnis, perhaps one of the most esteemed living natural law scholars in the world. Here is just an excerpt from their brief to the U.S. Supreme Court in the Dobbs case when it came to constitutional personhood. Quote, "The 14th Amendment, like the Civil Rights Act of 1866 it was meant to sustain, codified equality in the fundamental rights of persons, including life and personal security, as these were expounded in Sir William Blackstone's Commentaries on the Laws of England and leading American treatises. Blackstone's Commentaries exposition began with a discussion of unborn children's rights as persons across many bodies of law. Based on these authorities and landmark English cases, state high courts in the years before 1868 declared that the unborn human being throughout pregnancy, quote, is a person, and hence under, quote, civil and common law, quote, to all intents and purposes, a child as much as if born." 1868, of course, being the year that the 14th Amendment, which includes the Equal Protection Clause, was actually ratified. And I have been making this argument for years now in a post-Dobbs op-ed that I co-wrote with my friend Josh Craddock, who is another very outspoken advocate of this particular position. We co-wrote a piece for Newsweek in July of 2022, making many of these same arguments here. And let me just read a brief excerpt of that op-ed as well. Quote, "As Abraham Lincoln argued in his 1854 Peoria speech, the relevant moral and legal question in the antebellum slavery debate was whether a black American is not or is a man. So too is the relevant moral and legal question in the abortion debate whether the unborn child is not or is a natural person. We know the biological answer to that question, yes. Fortunately, a proper interpretation of the Constitution's 14th Amendment codifies that intuition into our legal charter. Because the unborn child is a natural legal person, according to authorities like Sir William Blackstone and an unbroken chain of state high court cases leading up to the 14th Amendment's ratification in 1868, a homicide statute that protects born persons but not unborn persons necessarily violates the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause." In fact, it's worth pointing out that even in the Dobbs case itself, which took the more punt to the democratic process position on abortion, Justice Samuel Alito actually not so subtly hinted at this. In fact, according to Alito, he, quote, "sharply distinguished other cases on which Roe versus Wade and Casey versus Planned Parenthood relied based on the reality that, quote, abortion destroys what those decisions call potential human life, and what the law at issue in this case regards as the life of, quote, an unborn human being." In other words, the abortion precedents are different from the Supreme Court's other so-called substantive due process precedents because it involves the destruction of potential or actual unborn human life. So look, that is the long-term way that this issue is going to have to play out. There is ultimately not going to be a patchwork system in place where human beings are protected under the rule of law in some states and not in others. We have murder statutes in all 50 states, homicide statutes, and the unborn child is going to have to ultimately be protected in all 50 states as well. We cannot ultimately have a system that, to kind of go back to the analogy from the antebellum period, is half free and half slave. We cannot have a patchwork system nowadays where the unborn child is protected in half of jurisdictions and not in the other half. For now, I don't have a huge issue with what Donald Trump said because I do live in the real world of political reality. I do hope that as a Floridian, and Donald Trump is a Floridian, this is where he has his domicile, is here in our state of Florida. As a Floridian, I hope that Donald Trump will help us defeat the radical pro-abortion measure that is now before the voters of Florida this fall as a ballot initiative. That would be my sincere hope for the former president as well. Well, that's it for today's deep dive. Up next in today's closing argument, we'll mix it up a little bit. National championship for the UConn Huskies once again. What does it mean? We'll break it all down for you. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's time for today's closing argument. The UConn Huskies are college basketball national champions yet again. They have gone back-to-back for the first time since the Florida Gators in 06-07, those Joakim Noah-led teams when Billy Donovan was the head coach before he made the leap to the NBA. Only the third time in my lifetime that a men's college basketball team has gone back-to-back. It is now UConn, Florida, and in the early 1990s, you had my beloved Duke Blue Devils go back-to-back with those Bobby Hurley, Christian Laettner, Grant Hill teams in the early 1990s. Just a totally dominant performance from start to finish for the UConn Huskies. They absolutely pummeled their way through this tournament. Their closest game was the Final Four, the national semifinal game against Alabama, where they were actually trailing for a few minutes at one time, and it was really a neck-and-neck game with 10 to 12 minutes to go before UConn started to pull away there. Dan Hurley has now joined an elite pantheon of college basketball head coaches in winning multiple national championships. There are really not a whole lot of coaches in the history of the game who have done this. UConn as a program has now won their sixth national title just since 1999. In fact, that 1999 national title game where UConn upset, again, my beloved Duke Blue Devils, and it was quite an upset. It was one of the biggest upsets based on the point spread in the history of the Final Four. UConn has now won six championships since 99. They are now tied for third on the all-time list of programs with the most national championships. They are tied with Duke's arch rival, the North Carolina Tar Heels, behind only UCLA and Kentucky. Just remarkable stuff what UConn has been able to do over the past 25 years when it comes to college basketball. They have reached seven Final Fours, and they have won the national title in six of those appearances. The only time they reached the Final Four and failed to win the national title was 2009. I don't particularly like UConn. I was scarred by that 1999 national championship game. That was an incredible Duke team. Elton Brand, Trajan Langdon, Will Avery, Corey Maggette. That team really should have won it all. I was scarred again in 2004 in the Final Four when UConn, led by Emeka Okafor and Ben Gordon, came back from down by 8 points with 3 to 4 minutes to go to upset again Duke by 1 point there in the San Antonio Final Four. That was a horrific upset. That Duke team, again, was stacked. J.J. Redick, Sheldon Williams, you name it. So I am not a fan of the UConn Huskies basketball program, but you have to respect greatness, and you have to give credit where credit is due. They are presumably celebrating today in Storrs, Connecticut. What a program that they have been able to build there, beginning with Coach Jim Calhoun, and then Kevin Ollie was the coach that won them that out-of-nowhere national title in 2014. And now we have entered the era of Dan Hurley, the brother of former Duke basketball legend Bobby Hurley. Wow, just remarkable stuff for the UConn Huskies. Again, I am not a fan, but you got to respect greatness and give credit where credit is due. That's it for today's America on Trial. Thanks as always for tuning in. We'll be right back with more America on Trial tomorrow morning.